You're listening to a UC San Diego podcast.
Okay. We may have to crawl through homeworks in 70 minutes. Sorry if you can't find it. That pile was alphabetical at some point. Do you mind taking a look later, guys? Sorry. It's kind of time to get started. They'll still be there in an hour. Your grades won't change. Okay. So, for future reference, when I put the homeworks out the front at the beginning of class, they should be alphabetically sorted. I think that lasted about the whole of 10 seconds, but when you're going through them in 2 weeks, try to keep them roughly alphabetized for the next person so we can sort through them a little bit more quickly. But anyway, they're not going anywhere. So today I wanted to sort of conclude recommender systems and also cover the first assignment, which is going to be due in 4 weeks' time. So we got most of the way through all of the basic models on Monday. We were looking at essentially two types of approach to recommendation. One based on the notion of finding similarity between users and similarity between items, and one based on the approach, one based on dimensionality reduction type approaches. Okay, so in essence, we were trying to model data that captures interactions between users and items. So interactions could mean a lot of things. Interactions could mean, given a user and an item pair, did they purchase it? Did they click on it? If they purchased it, did they like or dislike it? If they purchased it, did they give it a high rating or a low rating? Whatever. So it could be binary or numerical feedback, but it's data that describes the interactions between users and items. And recommender systems are sort of this general class of methods that try to model these types of interactions. And you can use those to personalize user experiences. You can use those to recommend the next web page you'll click on or the next product you'll buy or to estimate the rating you'll give to a particular item. Those are all how you use a recommender system, but at its heart, it's going to be this predictive task that tries to estimate, given a user and an item pair, how is the user going to respond to that item. So we started looking at a bunch of techniques to solve that type of problem. So the first two were based on these notions of finding items or finding users that are similar to each other. So this is how things like Amazon's people who viewed X also viewed Y feature works. It's based on coming up with some similarity measure that says, are two items similar based on the users who've purchased them in the past? Okay, and we saw a bunch of ways so that similarity can be measured, one of which is the way Amazon does it. First, we looked at the Jaccard similarity, which is for binary feedback, which could be, did a person click on something or did they purchase something? For that kind of feedback, we can come up with a similarity measure that's based on the idea of looking at sets of users who purchased an item and saying, are these two sets similar to each other? Now we moved on to real-valued feedback or even sort of plus or minus feedback. We needed something more complicated than a measure based on the notion of sets. So we started saying, all right, let's treat all of the users' feedback, positive or negative, as some vector in very high-dimensional space. And then we'll say that two users are similar to each other if these very high-dimensional vectors are close to each other. And the way we measured whether they were close was whether they had a small angle between them. So if it's a small angle, it means you evaluate things similarly. If it's a very large angle, it means you rate things in exactly the opposite way. So the largest angle could be is 180 degrees. The final thing we saw in terms of similarity functions was this Pearson similarity that said, well, maybe we'd also like to learn for each user or for each item what is their kind of personal rating scale. Is if two people rate the same item 1 star versus 5 stars, should I regard them as being similar or different? In order to answer that question, I have to answer, okay, is a rating of 3.5 stars positive or is it negative? Maybe it's positive for you, but it's negative for someone else. So I'm going to need to kind of normalize my data to learn for each user whether some particular numerical value is high or low for them. And once I've done that normalization, I can then compute the cosine similarity. So that's three similarity measures that we came up with for binary feedback, positive negative feedback, and arbitrary real valued feedback. And it's a pretty powerful set of techniques. Some real world recommended systems are actually built on these notions, but they weren't quite what we wanted in a predictive analytics class, in the sense that these are just similarity functions that we had to invent. You know, we used some intuitive notion to say, well, you know, what do I think similarity means for things like rating data? And then we hoped our similarity function somehow captured what we wanted. Yes, it's a very, very powerful set of models. What we really wanted to do is learn the notion of what makes users or items similar, using some supervised learning techniques. So we started with this big data set from Netflix, which was trying to set up recommender systems as a supervised machine learning problem, where here the goal is to fit some model, which is a function of the user and the item, such that it will predict their held out ratings as accurately as possible. That's a supervised learning technique now, in the sense that we can say for two models which one of them is quantitatively better at solving the predictive task we care about. So that's what Netflix wanted. They gave out some data set of 100 million ratings. They held out some additional million or so, and they said they'd give $1 million to whoever can predict these held out ratings 10% more accurately than their own best system. And that's the kind of model we started dealing with, where you want to minimize the mean squared error of these real valued predictions by coming up with whatever model you can that's going to predict the most accurately. And we built that model gradually. We don't have any temporal dynamics yet. We started with just a user and an item. Simplest model you can come up with, just always predicts the average. We know how to do that, right? We just we take all of the ratings, find the average, the MSE of that model, or the RMSE of that model is going to be equal to the standard deviation of the full rating data. Second simplest thing we can do is to say, all right, we'll fit some user and item-specific bias terms, which essentially encode, given some global offset, is some item better than other items, and is some user more generous than other users in terms of their ratings? And to say, how does the user rate an item? We just say, well, how good is that item, and how generous is the user? And we just combine those things totally independently. And, you know, we saw this model kind of has some problems because there is no interaction here between the user and the item. And even though it can predict ratings in terms of the MSE pretty accurately, it's kind of useless as a recommender system, because if you think, oh, I'm going to rank items based on which ones you like most, this kind of model is useless for that, because it's going to return the same ranking for every single user. Different users may have a slightly different offset, but whatever the globally most fantastic movie is, it's going to recommend that to everyone, and recommend the second most globally fantastic movie to everyone next. So it's useless at doing personalized recommendation, even if it's not bad at predicting ratings. So to do personalized recommendation, we needed to move on to this model, where we're trying to uncover some low-dimensional representation of the user and the item. So we're essentially trying to apply dimensionality reduction techniques, like we saw last week, to this supervised rating prediction task, which is exactly what we said we wanted with dimensionality reduction, right? We said we wanted to find those low-dimensional features that are going to be useful in some predictive capacity. So we're looking for what are the dimensions about movies and about users that explain why different people rate different movies differently. So you can imagine the dimensions that explain variance in movie ratings could be things like genre, quality of the plot, budget, which actors were in it. Those could be the things that cause people to rate movies differently. Of course, you don't want to feed those in as input. You want to discover those automatically from the data. So what this is going to give you, this type of model, is you're going to say what are the properties of the item, what are the preferences of the user, and the inner product is going to say how compatible are the user's preferences with the item's properties. So we made some pretty good headway into this model, I think. It has a very nasty-looking objective, but whatever. It's a smooth function. It turned out not to be convex, but we just threw our hands in the air and said, okay, we'll just compute its gradient, initialize it somewhere, hopefully sensible, walk in the right direction, see what we end up with. And, you know, believe me, you'll get to know this algorithm quite intimately for the assignment. It's a lot of fun. Okay, so that's about as far as we got. We started off at the beginning of this week, the best thing we knew how to do. Yeah, go ahead. Whatever you like. It's the same with PC, like how many PCA dimensions should you pick, okay. Right? We want to pick enough dimensions to explain the variance in the real data, but not so many dimensions that we overfit. So it's a tunable parameter. And, I mean, again, there's other issues like how many dimensions can you fit in memory? How many can you actually afford to run in a reasonable amount of time? How sparse is your data? Like, if I'm saying I want to fit 100 dimensions that describe people's movie opinions. How many times would I need to see you rate something before I could figure out what are the 100 dimensional reasons why you rated it? Like, if every user only rates 5 things, it's going to be impossible to figure out some really complicated multi-dimensional reasons for that. Like, if all you've seen is that I rated Harry Potter 5 stars, you've kind of got to estimate, oh, why did I rate it 5 stars? Like, is it for the action? Is it for the actors? Is it for the special effects? Is it because I like that genre? You don't know until you've seen me rate 5 or 10 more things. And the more dimensions you want to fit, the more things you've got to see the person rate. So, yeah, it's gonna be very data specific, and in practice it's going to be a hyperparameter that we tune on some validation set. Anyway, so anything called K is a hyperparameter for reference, and anything called lambda is a hyperparameter, at least in my slides. So where we started, before we had these techniques, the best thing we could do was something like linear regression. We'd try to use features, which could be demographics about a user, and we'd try to use features about an item, which could be its MPAA rating or its length or its genre. And we try to train something like a linear predictor based on those. And we said, okay, this has some problems in the sense that it's not going to capture interactions between the users and the items. And that's what led us to this model, ultimately. But we've ended up on totally the opposite end of the spectrum from where we started. We had a model that was based on nothing but features. And now we have a model which is not using any features at all. It's just a huge raw matrix of ratings, and that's all we have. So we threw out our features completely in order to get to where we got. So I guess the question is, should we have been so harsh about features? Maybe they can help us a little bit. Can't we use some combination of something like rating data and features to fit a better model? So, you know, you might think about us concatenating these two things together. We have our offset, our bias terms, our low dimensional factors. Why not also include some user demographic information and some item properties? Couldn't they help us a little bit? Well, I don't know. It's not clear. They might. So you might think, well, yeah, features can tell us attributes about items or attributes about users that explain a lot of variance about why people rate things differently. So why not use them in the model? But if you think about this model, we can kind of rewrite it in this original form on the left, where it's just an offset, 2 bias terms, and then some big inner product. So I don't know if you can see what I've done between these two steps. All I've done is move the item features over here, and I've moved gamma u in here and gamma I in here, and I've just rewritten these three inner products as one inner product with three terms. So it's a pretty simple transformation. But what this really says is that this model, which is an offset, two biases, plus an inner product, is actually equivalent to this model. It just has more dimensions. So instead of using this, instead of using all these features, why didn't I just use more unknown dimensions? Right? I think it's a kind of subtle argument, but the point here is that one reason to say you shouldn't use features is because this type of latent variable model, this dimensionality reduction model, is so powerful that anything which explains variance in the data, it's going to be able to capture. If a movie being an action movie explains variance in how people rate it, then we don't need a feature which says it's an action movie. We'll automatically discover some dimension which corresponds to action movies, and the feature didn't help us. So given enough data, there's no value in these features. The brute force dimensionality reduction approach is going to discover the important dimensions automatically. So this is what I kind of just said. There's no real expressive power by having a lot of features. And this is kind of true in the limit. If you have enough data, whatever explains the variance in your model is going to be captured by the dimensionality reduction approach. The counter argument is that these models are very complex, they're very high dimensional, they're going to be very prone to overfitting, so features might guard against that. Like if you've only ever seen me rate Harry Potter and no other movie, I gave it 5 stars, then you can't fit these complicated multi-dimensional models. You have no reason to think I rated it because of any one dimension rather than another. Features could tell you that. So if you don't have enough data about the user or the item to fit some low-dimensional term, this is called like the cold start problem, brand new user, brand new item, you can't fit low-dimensional terms, maybe features will help. So maybe if you know nothing about a user, if you had their demographics, it'd help you personalize things a little bit. So we'll see some extensions to this algorithm that do try and use features in some sensible way a bit later. Okay. So I've said everything before it came up on the slide, but there you go. All right, so what point have we reached now? We've seen basically three techniques. We saw recommended systems that are based on the notion of learning similarity between things, and we saw recommended systems that are based on the principle of dimensionality reduction. So for similarity, we had binary tasks, where we can use things like Jaccard similarity and set-based similarity measures, and we had real-valued tasks, where we're looking at things like the cosine and Pearson similarity. And now for dimensionality reduction, we've looked at real-valued tasks. So the final piece of the puzzle to have all of these four parts completed is to say, how can we use dimensionality reduction for a binary task? So we've seen how we can use dimensionality reduction to predict a rating or something like that, but how can we use this approach to predict some binary output, like did a user purchase something, yes or no? So this is going to be reasonably straightforward. I'm not going to go into it in too much detail. It's basically analogous with regression versus logistic regression. So we've kind of seen the real-valued predictors for these recommended system type tasks. The binary value predictors for the recommendation tasks are going to be, they're going to, roughly speaking, consist of shoving our models through some sigmoid function. So I'll show you the outline and you can fill in the gaps. So this is called one class recommendation, where you're just trying to say, well, I mean, in this case, it's did they purchase it, yes or no, that's your one class. You're trying to identify purchased things versus non-purchased things or any other binary categorization you can come up with. So, you know, this is what your matrix looks like now. Your rating matrix or your data matrix is now not star ratings, it's just binary feedback, which could be purchased or non-purchased or liked versus didn't like. So what we're going to do is we're essentially going to shove our model through this sigmoid function. So we could just try and estimate what's the probability that Rui equals 1. This would be one way to do it. But what we'll try and do instead is to say, what's the probability that Rui is greater than Ruj? So the difference between these two things is kind of a little bit subtle, but we could just try and estimate the binary values of this purchase matrix, essentially by using our existing model with a sigmoid function. Now, the problem with that is that when we compare, say, purchases to non-purchases, you don't know that a user dislikes everything they didn't purchase. It's kind of a much weaker signal, right? You know they liked what they did purchase, so somehow their preferences should be compatible with the properties of the things they did purchase. You can't quite say that for things they didn't purchase. Maybe they just didn't know about that thing yet, right? You can kind of make a weaker statement which says people should like things they did purchase at least as much as things they didn't purchase. So rather than trying to fit the binary matrix, we'll try and say, given something that was purchased and something that wasn't purchased, let's try and maximize the separation between those two. So the user should be more compatible with things they purchased than with things they didn't purchase. And then we'll just solve it using good old logistic regression. So a really fitting is the probability that the user U preferred item over I over item J, which is just saying the user's representation or their preferences are more compatible with I than they are with J. And we're going to optimize this with gradient ascent now, like we did with good old logistic regression. I mean, you can compute the derivative of this expression. What you'd like is to say this value is positive when item I was purchased and item J wasn't. You'd like it to be as positive as possible. So now you're looking over triplets of users, purchased items, and non-purchased items. So there's too many of those triplets to consider all of them, so in practice you'll just take some random sample. Okay, so that's the very high-level view of how you kind of convert this kind of real-valued recommender into a binary-valued recommender. For the assignment, we're going to do the real-valued recommender anyway, so I cover that one in more detail. If you want to go through the steps of this binary one, it's pretty much the same sort of proof and derivative calculations as what we saw with logistic regression. So that kind of brings us to the end of these basic recommended systems concepts. We have similarity functions, we have dimensionality reduction approaches, and we have real valued and binary data. And we've covered all the bases, so to speak. All right, so there are two things I want to cover this evening. One is some extensions to recommender systems. Really, more interestingly, what actually won the Netflix prize. And the other is the assignment, of course. So I think I have plenty of time for both. So I'll just power ahead with some more complex recommender systems. Anything that's bugging anyone at this point? We're happy with the basics? Okay. All right, so we've started with this basic framework for dimensionality reduction-based recommendation, or, you know, recommendation based on supervised learning in general, where we'd like to minimize something like a mean squared error. This is really the building block for which all of the solutions to the Netflix Prize were based. You want to solve an objective that looks something like, well, you want this to be as close as possible to the real ratings with some regularizer. Now we'll estimate those two. Why not? So it's the same with like a regular linear regression type model. I mean, you could just say, oh, I'll fix the offset to be the average. But in practice, the offset term is one you will also fit from data. And once you fit it, it's not necessarily going to be the average anymore, right? It's actually saying, what would the prediction be if all features were set to zero, which is a slightly different statement from just being the average. So you can try fitting one of these things and convince yourself that the maximum or the minimum mean squared error solution for alpha is not going to be quite the average value. So yeah, fit them all. So we'd like to try and extend this in some way. I mean, already it's a very powerful model once you can scale it up to 100 million ratings or whatever you have. But we'd like to, well, one, maybe we'd like to bring features back in. We said they could be okay. If we don't know much about a user or an item, features could help us. So it could help us to alleviate this sort of cold start issue we might have. Second, we'd like to handle implicit feedback. So implicit feedback is basically all of those things you might do on a rating website other than rating things. So if you think about Amazon, or even Netflix for that matter, most of the actions you perform are not rating things. Most people probably never actually rate something on Amazon, but they purchase things and they click on things. So you have this sort of weaker source of data that somehow indicates your opinion, even though you didn't rate something, and we'd like to use that as additional signal to predict ratings. Yeah? So maybe if you click on some movie on Netflix, but you then don't watch it, you know, what does this mean? Maybe the fact that you clicked on it indicates interest in some level, but maybe the fact that you clicked on it yet didn't watch it indicates dislike. So I don't know, but we're going to kind of be agnostic to that and say, can we just learn the extent to which this type of implicit background activity could help us to predict your rating distributions more accurately? And the third thing, which is really the Netflix relevant one that won them the $1 million, is how do people's ratings change over time? Okay, so the best place to look up this stuff is this magazine article by Yehuda Karen, who's colloquially known as Mr. Netflix. It's a very, very approachable article. It's not an academic paper by any means. It's just a magazine article because, you know, he was so famous after winning the cash that they asked him how he did it, and this is sort of a very high level of the type of information he tried to encode into his team's model. Okay, so the first feature, this is not one that's really relevant to Netflix, but one that's useful for a lot of recommender systems, which is how can you incorporate features, which we'd like to do in things like cold start settings, whether they're about the users or the items. So we'll just assume we have a bunch of binary attributes about users, say their gender, whether they live in a specific location, whether their age is within some range. These could be used to tell us about new users what they're likely to enjoy, right? So what we'd like to do is to say, all right, if we don't know anything about a user, maybe we can still estimate these sort of low-dimensional factors that say how much do they like action, how much do they like romance, how much do they like comedy, by saying what's kind of the base low-dimensional representation that goes with that attribute. So, you know, your basic male maybe likes action 20% less than other users. They like romance 30% more, whatever. And then you can aggregate all of these things together to say, how much does having this attribute impact my estimate of your low-dimensional factors? So when I add all of these things together, it's saying if I know nothing about a user, if I've never rated anything before, then I can still say, well, their low-dimensional user term is going to be just the sum of all of these things. So, all right, so yeah, essentially each of these dimensions corresponds to a low-dimensional vector that offsets each of those dimensions. It says how much does somebody with this attribute like action more than other people or less than other people. And the model looks roughly like this, exactly the same as the previous model we had with one extra bit. So we still have our offset and bias and our low-dimensional user times our low-dimensional item factors. All we're doing is adding in these attribute-based offsets. So, and we're fitting it in the usual way to try and minimize the MSE. But what's important here is that our regularizer is going to kind of squash these terms if we haven't seen the item very much. We've never seen the user before. This term is going to be pushed to zero, and we're going to rely on this term, which says, if we've never seen the user before, well, we have their attributes to tell us what their low-dimensional representation is likely to be. Whereas, if we've seen the user many, 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 many times, we're allowed to take large values for the low-dimensional factors. The regularizer doesn't matter anymore. That means we can kind of override, or we can overrule this background model. So the more we see the user, the less we rely on features, which is exactly what we wanted. You know, if we haven't seen the user before, we have our cold start solution. And if we have seen the user a lot before, we rely on dimensionality reduction to solve the problem. So it kind of gives us the best thing in between those two ends of the spectrum I said before. Okay, so the second thing is implicit feedback. It's going to end up being a very similar approach. We're going to treat implicit feedback as some kind of a binary vector describing users' actions. Yeah? You could. You could have the same bit attached to the model where you had item features as well. I forget exactly what the data set I had in mind for this model was, but it was one where user features were reliable and item features were not, apparently. But yeah, certainly, you could have the equivalent of this term, but for items and item features. I mean, at least in a Netflix-type setting, you have a relatively small item vocabulary, and many, 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 many users rate each item. So you don't have to deal with sparsity of item ratings at all. And that's often the case, where you have some limited vocabulary of items but some huge population of potential users, many of whom are very inactive. Then you need user features, but you don't need item features. That make sense? Sure, yeah. That's true. For a brand new item, you would need something like that. But then again, you know, you can wait 10 seconds until 10,000 people have evaluated the item. Yeah, I mean, you've got to have some way of surfacing the item on the user interface to begin with before anyone's rated it. Okay, so the second thing, implicit feedback, we're going to incorporate it in the same way. So we're going to treat implicit feedback as a bunch of binary indicators for each user. So one position said, well, I clicked on Love Actually, but I didn't watch Love Actually. What does that mean? And we'll handle it in the same way. So maybe the fact that I clicked on it but didn't watch it says, you know, it decreases my prediction for romantic comedies a little bit and increases my prediction for action a little bit or something like that. And then we can kind of just aggregate all of a user's actions in the same way by saying what impact do they have on our estimate of their low-dimensional factors. Then it's the same kind of model. This is exactly the same as the previous expression. There's one additional term which this Karen character said was particularly effective when dealing with this type of data, which is he just normalizes by the number of actions. So this, empirically at least, it stops the model from becoming totally saturated by users who click on millions and millions of things but don't do anything, apparently. So it's essentially saying that all of your actions count for one collectively. Okay, so the more important thing for Netflix is how people's ratings change over time. So here's a quick plot of some Netflix data, not mine. This is from Karen's paper, in fact. This is the lifetime of the data set on the x-axis from the first to the last rating, and on the y-axis, the mean score. So there's kind of this elbow in the middle. Who had a Netflix account in 2004? Not me. No one? So who can guess what happened? 2004. Google. More boring. Iraq? No. Well, I don't know. It may have changed people's Netflix ratings, but not by this much. Okay, it's the most boring thing possible. It's a Netflix UI change. So this is a temporal dynamic, and we have to account for it. I don't know what the UI change was, but you can imagine, you know, they say when you're entering a star rating, they say what they think one star corresponds to and what two stars correspond to. So I guess they just changed the wording, so now people have a different interpretation of that star rating, and they suddenly everyone rates things differently. Now we need to account for that. So the sort of bad way you could account for that is say, well, okay, we can't use any of our old ratings. This previous data is junk. Let's just try and fit our model based on the new UI. The other way is to say, well, but it's a systematic shift, so I can model it. I can actually capture the fact that, well, I'd like to use this old data to fit my model of users' preferences, but I'd like to capture the fact that it systematically went up by a bunch at such and such a date. Something else that happens on Netflix, it's no longer when the rating was entered on the x-axis, but the x-axis is now how old was the movie when the rating was entered. So it's independent of the time. It's not saying that movies got better recently or anything. It's saying when the movie was evaluated, how old was it? So it's saying people perceive old movies as being better somehow for some reason. So I don't know why that is. One reason could just be people experience nostalgia and they just find that they like old things better because they're more generous toward them. The other reason could be a more simple sort of UI-based one, which is that you get a lot of exposure to brand new things on Netflix, so you're more likely to watch new things that you don't like. Whereas if you watch something that's 10 years old, you probably searched for it, you probably knew you liked it, you knew that you would like it in advance. So the very fact that you're choosing to watch something old is an indicator that you already know you like it. But again, it's a systematic kind of temporal factor that we should account for when building a model. A few more about beer. I guess I already showed you one. Back in week one, people tend to rate beers more highly around New Year. There's like seasonal effects going on. Probably it's not because people are depressed during August. It's probably because they're just drinking worse beer then. I don't know. It's a different kind of seasonal beer or something. You know, also have short-term temporal dynamics. Like this is during a single day. People tend to give the highest ratings around midnight. And, you know, you really shouldn't be drinking at 11 a.m. My favorite one actually is sort of this notion of fatigue. So you can look on this data set for people who've entered many, many, many ratings within a single day. So the top users, they're entering 20 beer ratings and presumably consuming 20 beers in one day. And you can see how their ratings systematically go down as they drink more and more and more. So this is kind of a temporal effect in the sense that the order in which the actions perform matter. Had these beers been evaluated in a different order, people would have rated them differently. So it's something else we should take into account. Like, what did you rate previously, and how does that impact what we think your next rating is going to be? And, you know, anyway, there's all kinds of things that go on. There's UI changes. You know, there's bias towards older movies. There's gradual changes in the community over time. There are, like, geopolitical events that just might change people's opinion dynamics. There's the introduction of new products or competitive services that might change the population who's rating things. You know, maybe somebody else starts using my Netflix account. Okay, that's a temporal dynamic. It's like it looks as if my rating distribution has suddenly changed drastically. And, you know, we'd like to account for the fact that, or maybe it goes back down again after a week, or who knows. We'd like to account for the fact that there's this blip or this noise in the data at a particular point in time. You know, maybe I binge watch all of Buffy and then go back to normal. It's something, you have some actions that are, inconsistent with my normal behavior, and you'd like to account for that sudden abnormality in the model. Another one that I like is maybe you just become a connoisseur of things. So maybe the fact that you've watched many, 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 many movies causes you to evaluate certain movies differently. If Citizen Kane is the first thing you ever watch, you'd probably find it hopelessly boring. But if you've watched thousands and thousands of movies, maybe you've learned to appreciate it and you like it more. So just the fact that you've watched a lot of things before it could impact what your rating looks like. And yeah, there's all kinds of other things. There's seasonal effects. There's something called anchoring, which basically says that if you already see everyone hates something, it's going to probably make you form a negative opinion of it as well. And there are various academic papers to try and capture all of these kinds of temporal effects through different and more complicated models. So the basic idea is we'd like to take this basic model that we have as a building block and incorporate temporal information into it into some way. I'll cover this more in the temporal lecture in week 10, but basically what we're going to do is the following, is to say that some or all of these parameters are going to change as a function of time. So I guess this change in the user interface could be captured by a temporally evolving global bias term, or a change in the way movies are perceived as they get older could be a temporally evolving item bias term. It just is a linear function of the difference between now and when the movie was released, and so on and so forth. You know, maybe people like action movies during summer. This could be accounted for by seasonal effects in a dimension of the user's low-dimensional representation. And we'll just, however we do that, I'll show you a bunch of ways at another time, but we'll try and fit the same sort of model. Maybe we'll add some additional regularizer which says that within a short span of time, people don't change too much so that we can capture things like smooth dynamics. But that's the basic idea. So later, actually, probably not given how we're going for time, but when I have time for another case study, I can talk to you about temporal dynamics in beer reviews. So here we were studying this notion of becoming a connoisseur. So how many beers you've consumed in the past is going to influence the kind of ratings you give to beers in the future. So what we found is that sort of expert users, people who've rated a lot of beers, tend to systematically rate things different from beginners. In particular, you know, these IPAs that everyone in San Diego likes so much. If the first beer you drink, you won't like them. Apparently, I still haven't drank enough beer to like them, so I'm still somewhere down here on the Bud Light end of the spectrum. Anyway, it's a fun story for another time. Another kind of extension is this sort of missing not at random assumption. This essentially says that the very fact that you're choosing to evaluate something gives us information about what your evaluation is likely to be. People don't necessarily evaluate every restaurant they visit on Yelp. They might evaluate it if they really liked it or if they really hated it. But if it was just okay, they may not even bother. So there's some sort of bias based on the fact that you chose to enter a review, at least in some data sets, about what your rating is likely to be. So if we want to predict ratings for everything as accurately as possible, we should somehow account for that bias when we're training our model. So, you know, you can see different movie data sets based on whatever it is, changes in the UI or something like that, have quite different distributions of how people rate things. One place you definitely see this is if you buy your clothes on Amazon. I mean, who here buys their clothes on Amazon? It's probably just me. I certainly don't buy $35,000 watches, but generally speaking, you see a lot of opinions that have a distribution like this, where people either really like the item or they really hate it. You don't buy a $35,000 watch and just say, yeah, it's okay. So, especially with things like luxury goods, you see a lot of rating distributions that look like this. And, you know, somehow you might want to account for the fact that your decision to enter a rating is a function of your rating. So we have a different prior for ratings for purchased versus non-purchased items. Okay, so getting to the end of the story, what actually worked on Netflix. This is basically a nice plot of how different extensions to this basic latent factor, dimensionality reduction type of model helped get the RMSE down by more and more and more. So the basic model here, right up the top, just looks like gamma u dot gamma I. The value 40 here says that was a model with k is equal to 40 dimensions. So k equals 40. And then this curve here is saying as you increase k, how much does your error go down? So that's the very, very, very basic model, which has user and item factors, and eventually it sort of asymptotes as you increase k. Either it really asymptotes or k gets so large that you just can't afford to fit a bigger model. So you kind of get stuck pretty quickly. The first simple observation is, yeah, we should add some bias terms to this model. It'll help us to regularize it better. But that's still pretty simple. Helps a little bit, not by too much. The real place where you start to get big improvements is implicit feedback. So I think the way they used implicit feedback on Netflix is to, maybe somebody will know more about this than me, but they have, at least from the test set, they know what you purchased, even if they don't know how you rated it. So that can be used to, as a form of implicit feedback, to train the model about how you're likely to rate things. But what really, really, really helped was these models of temporal dynamics. And there's a whole bunch that they included, which I'll cover in week 10. But that's what kind of won them the Netflix prize. So the moral of the story that's captured in this plot is you can increase the complexity of your model, in other words, the number of dimensions, you can increase k. But if your model's not the right model, that's not going to help very much. What really, really helps is, and this is true of all data mining, I guess, is thinking very, very hard about the problem and trying to come up with a model that captures the relevant dynamics that are at play. So some of these are very, very Netflix-specific things that happen to work well for this one problem, but they had to really work hard to use a model that's not just generic and quite adaptable, but a model that really captures the important things that are going on Netflix. Okay, so how does the story end? So initially, Yehuda Karen and his team, they were the early leaders from AT&T, and yeah, efficiently incorporating temporal dynamics was their basic insight. Fairly quickly, people realized that with all the people working on it and people starting to team up and build these sort of Frankenstein predictive models, there wasn't going to be just one winner of the small team of engineers trying to build the best model, but the best solution was going to be some big combination of many, many, many people's efforts. So teams started to join forces. Bellcore's pragmatic chaos was, I think, maybe three teams, one of which was Bellcore, of course, and the ensemble was some huge conglomerate of, I forget how many. Bellcore was the first to get to this point of reducing the RMSE by 10%. So the way the Netflix competition worked, that didn't end the competition. It just put the competition into last call mode, where you now had 30 days. So, you know, maybe some people were hiding their best ideas from everyone else, and now that the competition was about to be over, people would just go all in with every single thing they possibly had and try to come up with the best possible model. So then after 30 days, that's when the performance on the hidden part of the test set was finally evaluated to determine the winner. Miraculously, both of these front teams had the same RMSE. So up to some reasonably high precision, which they had said they were going to measure it at. But Bellcore got there 20 minutes earlier. So they won the clash. And the moral here is submit your assignments early. Okay, so if you want to know more about this, the place to look is actually, I mean, the Wikipedia page is fantastic, but the New York Times article it links to is a very, very long, detailed history of the Netflix Prize. It's well worth a read. So quick afterword, yes, there was this class action lawsuit against Netflix after the data was de-anonymized. as I mentioned, on Monday. Beyond that, I guess it's very cheap for Netflix, who has a lot of cash, to front $1 million and then get dozens and dozens and dozens of very highly paid industrial researchers to look at their pet problem for several years. So a lot of others have tried to do the same thing. The Heritage Health Prize is a very similar thing. $3 million, and there your task is to predict how long some user's next hospital stay is going to be. And this one was run on Kaggle, which is the same website we use for the assignment. Something else, well, the winning ridiculous solution was never actually implemented by Netflix. So it's not clear they got good value for their $1 million or not. This is anecdotal at least, but apparently what Netflix is doing, whatever that is something much, much simpler, but much, much more real-time. I mean, this outrageously complicated Frankenstein solution is something that's hard to modify, takes a very, very long time to train. Netflix, in practice, wants something that you watch a movie, by the time you're finished watching the movie, it has new recommendations for you, so they can update the model very, very quickly. And then the last kind of question to think about on your own is whether minimizing the RMSE by 10% is really the thing to do anyway, whether that's going to drastically improve recommendations. So I think it's a little unclear. So does a 10% improvement give you better recommendations? Well, maybe you care about what's ranked near the top. Even a small change in RMSE could drastically change those few items that, or the ordering of the few items that are ranked near the top. So it could have a very large, profound effect. On the other hand, I mean, just having a good predictive model is only a tiny part of the story. There are all these other issues like, oh, how can I maximize account for diversity in the recommendations rather than just recommending several identical things, all of which I like quite a lot. It's unclear how much MSE helps, and even if it helps, it's only a small part of actually building a good recommender system. Yeah? Yeah, I guess. Probably there is part of their model that they train monolithically once every week or something like that. And then there's another part they want to update very quickly. I guess Amazon has similar things too, right? They have, when you click on a product, you wouldn't know, of course, but when you click on a product, it says people who viewed X also viewed Y. That's totally non-personalized, but it doesn't require updating very frequently. And then maybe when you go to the homepage every day, it has some new recommendations just for you that have been trained offline the night before or something like that. So who knows? Probably having a high fidelity model is useful, but it's only a small part of the recommender system story. So that's basically it for recommender systems. We have some ways of incorporating features and implicit feedback and all these other complicated assumptions like temporal dynamics and missing not at random and the good old Netflix prize. So before I get to the assignment, what didn't I get to? Well, another fun topic is how can you use things like social data in recommended systems? This is kind of its whole problem in and of itself, to say how can we model how people influence the opinions or are influenced by the opinions of their friends. So that's about it for recommender systems. I'll talk about assignment one now, unless there are just absolutely pressing questions about Netflix or recommendation technology. We're happy? Oh, wait a minute. Escape, keep. The first assignment. So it's on the course webpage since yesterday. It's going to be due in 4 weeks minus a day, so midnight on Tuesday night. And I want it to be due then so that I can announce the winners in this class in 4 weeks' time, okay? So there'll be no extensions. It'll automatically shut itself down at the stroke of midnight. So make sure you get in on time. The only reason I would extend it is if Kaggle goes down, which happened before once, but please don't mount a denial of service attack the day before the assignment's due. There's also, I mean, mostly we're grading you automatically based on this Kaggle page, but there's also a short report that you should submit to one of the TAs whose names I've volunteered. So data's online, the spec is online, you can look at those later. The data basically looks like this. It's pretty familiar to us. It's sort of a million lines, one Python dictionary per line. They're book reviews this time that we're going to try and solve predictive tasks about. So you have, you know, the time of day, the category, summary, rating, item ID, user ID, helpfulness votes, and the review, you know, favorite of the series. May not have been as steamy as some of the others, but the characters, their depth and believability were amazing. So, who's read this? Who knows who Devlin is? I don't know. Sounds like a good book. And we'd like to solve some predictive tasks about this data, one of which is, can we predict whether a review is helpful or not? So this is probably going to be some kind of regression-type task. We're also going to use, probably, some features of the text, which we'll talk about next week. Maybe not. You know, there's all kinds of other ways you could solve this besides using a text. The text, you could use a recommender system that learns the extent to which a particular user writes helpful reviews or items tend to receive helpful reviews. So you can see exactly the same kind of approaches we've seen today and also the kind of things we've seen with regular regression based on features from the text itself. So really we want some predictor that says, given a user and an item and out of, which is the number of helpfulness votes, I mean the number of votes, whether positive or negative, the item received, and you want to predict what fraction of those were positive as a measure of its helpfulness. And the other task is to predict star ratings. So essentially what we talked about for half of Monday's lecture, right? I think this is the harder task, but in some sense there's also fewer ways you could do it. Probably implementing something like what I described, you know, reasonably well-regularized, well-initialized dimensionality reduction type approach is going to be what works here. Whereas here, I almost have no clue what would work best. I have a bit of a clue. So the first task, this helpfulness prediction task, is going to be evaluated by the mean absolute error, which is a bit weird, nothing too shocking. There's no squared here, so it's not a mean squared error. Why use the absolute error here rather than the squared error? Well, we don't want items that received huge numbers of votes to saturate the model, right? So if we use the mean squared error and you predicted an item got 9,000 helpfulness votes where it actually got 10,000, that would have a penalty of 1,000,000 with the mean squared error. So it would count as much as if you got votes wrong just by 1,000,000 times. Whereas we're only going to say that has penalty 1,000. So no matter how many votes an item has received, one vote always counts for the same. So, and to put it more simply, what the mean absolute error here captures is, on average, how many individual votes did you predict incorrectly? The other one is just the root mean squared error. So it's exactly the Netflix prize type setup. Of course, you do have a bunch of features associated with the product, so maybe you could use those to do something fancy, but I think doing it the Netflix prize way is a pretty sensible option. So the test data, obviously it's secret. What I have given you, though, is these pairs. So that says for which users and items should you make predictions. So the test data looks like this. This is simulated test data. It's not the real thing. So this is the real test data, and all I've done is remove the last column. You've got to fill that in. Upload your solution to Kaggle. I've also provided a few simple baselines I mean, they're really trivial, but they're more to give you a feel for the format of the data and the format of the output. So if you run these baselines, it'll generate a valid Kaggle output that you can then upload. So really this is a block of code that you can modify to build your solutions inside of. The two baselines are really straightforward. It's just saying the helpfulness baseline is going to predict the global average helpfulness rate or the user's average if we've seen that user before. So it's some model that basically looks like alpha plus beta u. That's our helpfulness model. I'm sure you can improve upon that. The second one is for the rating prediction task. Again, it's the same sort of thing. It's just a global average. Jesus. It's a global average plus some personal bias term for each user. And again, that's what you've got to build upon. So the Kaggle web pages are already up, so go ahead and run the baseline file, create yourself some funny username, and upload an initial solution. So there's two pages. The first one is going to be shared between 190 and 255. So that's the helpfulness prediction. Everyone's got to do that. You've got to show you're better than the undergrads. That's why you're here. The second one is the rating prediction task. That's just for this class. They're doing one which is binary purchase prediction. So it's the real valued versus the binary version of this task. Now, the reason I split it that way, I guess, is it's not because one of these tasks is harder, but I think the way to solve this one is through calculus. Let's put it like that. I don't know how else you're going to solve it except by computing some derivatives and converting them to code, whereas purchase prediction, there are other heuristics that can work pretty well for people who don't like math so much. You all like math, so that's why you get this one. Okay, so for grades, yeah, it's a competition, so your grade is partly determined by how well you do compared to the rest of the class, but not too much. There's 3 out of 10 for being at the top of the leaderboard, well, or being at some position of the leaderboard. But mostly it's just how much you can beat the baseline. So you can get almost full marks for the assignment. I mean, everyone can get almost full marks for the assignment just by coming up with a sensible solution that beats these sort of simple baselines by a decent amount. Finally, there's going to be a written report. So that's worth 5 out of 25 marks. Mostly those are for people who really struggled with the assignment, so that we can give partial credit. If you did something sensible and you got a good solution, then really you just want to tell us enough so that we could reproduce your solution and be convinced that you came up with something sensible rather than just, oh, I crawled Amazon and de-anonymized all the data. Don't do that. It'll be harder than solving the assignment. Okay, and of course there's fabulous prizes. So on November 18, the winners for both tasks will receive fantastic prizes to the value of $1.29. Now, you know, we know this psychological study that says giving cash rewards for things doesn't incentivize people to work harder. Hopefully this doesn't deter you from doing good work, though. And that's about it. So finally, the homework 3, which will come out next week, is basically going to be to set you up working on some kind of reasonable solution to the assignment. So splitting up the data, building your own validation set, so on and so forth. Okay. So, yeah? Yeah, so, all right, we're almost at the end. So Kaggle will just take a UCSD email address. So I shouldn't need to invite anyone. There are a few people who, for some reason, have gotten to this point in their life without a UCSD email. So if you're such a person, tell me and I can send you an invite. I mean, if you want to do the undergraduate task as well and just show them how much better you are than them, then you're welcome to do that too, if you want to do purchase prediction as well. So I thought I'd finish with a few words saying what's different compared to the assignment last year. There's one big difference that I'll just sort of leave you with. Okay, obviously it's about books rather than some other category. But last year, the data set was kind of hopelessly sparse. So the average user had only two or three reviews, and the average item had only two or three reviews, which made it very difficult for people to come up with solutions that were based on the principle of dimensionality reduction. So people tended to gravitate more towards heuristics that would work well for new users. So this year, what I did instead is I tried to set up the data so that some combination of techniques would work. So if you think about this bipartite graph between the users and the items, it says who rated or who purchased what, then I took like the dense core of this graph. So this is called like a K-core, so a two core would consist of iteratively deleting every edge of degree less than 2 in this graph. So I'll delete this, I'll delete this, I'll delete this edge. You know, even though it originally had degree higher than 2, I'm going to keep doing it until every single node that's left has degree higher than 2. So I'll delete this, I'll delete this, and I'm left with a graph like this. So I took something like the 10 or the 20 core of this review graph, which leaves us with a relatively dense set of users where pretty much every user in the training set or every user or item in the test set shows up many times in the training set so that you can actually fit sort of complicated high-dimensional models. So I expect the set of solutions that work well this year will be fairly different than the ones that worked well last year. So I think I'll just leave it on that, unless there are any last-minute questions. Otherwise, the homework is still here if you want to collect it.
This has been a UC San Diego podcast. For more, visit podcast.ucsd.edu.